This episode is brought to you by Hodinkee Insurance. Collecting watches is fun. Insuring watches is not. But with Hodinkee Insurance, we've teamed up with Chubb, the premier insurer of valuable collections, to offer a better and more seamless experience to insure your watches and even jewelry, minimizing the paperwork and maximizing the protection so you can stop worrying about your watches and focus on enjoying them. Hodinkee Insurance, protect what you love. Visit insurance.hodinkee.com for more details. Welcome back to another episode of Hodinkee Radio. Today, my guest is Sebastian Chalmonte. Sebastian is the Director of Innovation and Marketing at Sellita. His career in watches has also included stints with Le Jeu Perret, Arnold & Son, and Angelus, but he started as a collector, particularly of vintage chronographs. He even wrote a book about them and is working on another. Besides Sellita, he also just launched his own brand, Albishorn, which is what we'll get into here at the end as well, the goal of which is to create small batches of what he calls imaginary vintage watches. I've known about Sebastian for years, but only had the pleasure of meeting him last month in Geneva. He's as passionate and knowledgeable as they come, so I'm excited to have him on the podcast. We're going to talk about collecting vintage chronographs, Sellita, Albishorn, and even what the Swiss watch industry can do better. Sebastian, thanks for joining the show.
Thanks for having me.
I'm excited to have you on the show because we met as you were introducing your new brand, Albishorn, and your first collaboration with Messina Lab, the Maxigraph. But you just mentioned to me that you are coming up on 7 years at Sellita. So congratulations on that. And we're going to talk more about your time at Sellita. But before we get into that, I want to talk about how you got into watches initially, because my understanding is, even I know this to be true because you've written books about it, you were a collector, particularly of vintage chronographs, for years before you became a professional in the industry.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So I was quite early on, very interested into watches, without no obvious reason, and the fact that my family is not. So it's something I developed for myself. So I think they're still wondering why actually what they did wrong, but it caught me quite young to be very enthusiastic about watches, and chronographs very, very early on caught my attention. So I focused quite early on chronographs only. But of course, at the beginning, I was very into watches in general. But yeah, chronographs have this magical combination of complication, of design. And it's one of the few movements you can interact with, because I don't advise anyone to play with a perpetual calendar. It's the best way to break it. And the chronograph is also why it's such a challenging technical instrument, is that you can play with it. You can flyback it if it's a flyback. Don't try it if it's not, because it's the best way to break it. But it's a very interactive watch, and you have a quite wide diversity. You can have it combined with a perpetual calendar if you can buy some Patek Philippe. So at the time, or nowadays, you can get it also from other brands. But yeah, the chronograph is something, I think, for many males, especially collectors, something very technical, so very appealing. Yeah, I started with chronographs, obviously. I started like at the age of 15 or something. I was into watches before, actually. I bought the very first watch for my mom on the flea market. It was a little Omega. Before I realized that buying it was one thing, having it repaired was another one. So it took me about four or three years to find a solution how to make it run. It was a little ladies watch from Art Deco period. But yeah, so I started to be very seriously into watches being 15 years old. So I got quite technical quite early on, reading patterns and disassembling, I think, like many people do, or many interested people do, odd watches. But I was also very keen from a very early age on to become a lawyer. It was an obsession. So I finally became a lawyer, actually. I ended up by also writing a PhD. I ended up in the industry, but in parallel, I was already developing technical stuff, patenting solutions. I also worked with Harbring, for instance, on the chronograph without bushers. We have a common patent on that. So it's something dating back over 25 years. So it doesn't make me any younger. So I was pursuing my career. I had a job in Zurich in the biggest Swiss law firm. And then as I was specialized in watches, I ended up on the team which had to sue or attack the Swatch Group, because as you know, at the time they decided to disrupt or to interrupt deliveries of key components to the Swiss industry. And I ended up being in a team defending one of the companies which was the most affected by that decision. And we get to know each other much better with the investors and owner of this company. And at some point they say, yeah, but you know a bit even more than about law. You are pretty good at developing. So I sold a few development. At some point they say, do you want to take it over? And it's how I ended up at Le Jeu, where I spent 10 years.
I didn't know that background about you, that's how you actually got into the watch industry, was
yeah,
by
yeah, yeah.
the one of the biggest lawsuits that affected the Swiss watch industry about 2 decades ago at this point.
Yeah, and it costed me a few years of my existence because obviously I continued suing them. Or suing is not the right word because it was under competition law. So it's antitrust issues. But yeah, being at Lajoux, and then also we had the last round of troubles in that respect also with Sellita, which was the second big company affected by this decision. So I would say I spent like almost 20 years of my life devoted to this topic of what you can and what you can't on the Swiss law regarding antitrust.
You mentioned 15 years old, got into chronographs pretty quickly after that. Were you, as a collector, were you more interested in the, it kind of sounds like you were, the technical side of chronographs and the movements and all of that? And then can you talk about how it's evolved from there? I imagine you've become more interested in the design since then.
Yeah, exactly. That's actually my biggest mistake I did. I started by a big mistake as a collector. I was very into technical aspects of it and movements. So for me, basically, any Le Mania was as good as being sitting into a Speedmaster. So I was like collecting Venus, but not looking if they were in a Navi Timer from Breitling or anything else. My aim at the very beginning was to own as many different calibers I could. I actually, no matter the design. So I also bought watches I didn't like just because of the movement inside. And obviously, as you know, a Valjoux 72 has a bit of more of value when it's into a Daytona than some kind of Croton or whatsoever. But I was going to the Valjoux 72, no matter if it's a Carrera or not. That I learned the lesson because I missed some good, probably some good buys at the time. But yeah, I was very, very focused on the technique, on the technical solutions, and having, I mean, this obsession of having every version of every chronograph ever made.
But then from there, I imagine it evolved a little bit and you
Evolved massively because I understood that I did some mistakes in the sense that the watch is obviously what makes it so magical is the combination of technique and aesthetics. And it's only when everything is matching that actually you have a fabulous product, and you cannot reduce it to just pure design, or you cannot probably reduce it to pure technique. Even if you have to reduce it to anything, I see nowadays I would say it should be design. But obviously the marvel of watches in general is this incredible combination of being something which has to be a tool and have to be resistant to water, to shock, to magnetism, or to whatsoever, and still being something quite beautiful. And I think the big complexity, and you see today when we do huge watches which are too thick to everything, is because we want to make them resistant to almost everything we think they should resist. And when you look at especially vintage watches, you have this elegance, this kind of magic, and it shows how difficult it is actually to combine all these elements in that little thing, being both attractive but also practical, something you wear on your wrist like every day. And having an interesting technical content, if possible. That is probably what attracted me so much to watches to start with, is that all these elements, you can approach it by loving Art Deco style or Bauhaus style whatsoever. You can approach it by the jewelry aspect of it when you have a wonderful gold case, and obviously by crazy chronographs, especially when you go into Attrapante and those split seconds. So I started by having a keen eye on techniques, and I tried to revise it later on, probably a bit late because, yeah, I was not the only one. But I'm still, I would say, a technical nerd, and I will probably die being a technical nerd. But on my way, I learned to really dig design a lot.
Angelus is one of the brands that I know is quite near and dear to you. Can you talk about maybe how that fits into your collecting philosophy and why in the history of the brand?
Well, Angelus, if you look at it, of course, it was part of the very few real chronograph manufacturers. So obviously, when you start collecting chronographs, you make a difference if they have a movement from Ebauche SA, meaning Landron, Valjoux, or Venus. Even this probably is probably wrong because the biggest design have been done based on stock movements. Might it be a Navi Timer, Chronomat, or Daytona, or Carrera? So all the big names people collect nowadays are based on these movements. But as a nerd, you prefer an Excelsior Park movement, an Angelus, you prefer an Universal Genève, which is actually a Martel movement, but well. So an Angelus, yeah. Angelus was by far the most creative chronograph producer because they not just simply made a simple chronograph. They came up with a Chronodato, which was the first serial produced calendar, which was not a perpetual, because as you know, was Patek Philippe. But the first idea of combining a chronograph with a calendar in a wristwatch was done by Angelus with a Chronodato. Then came their masterpiece, which almost killed them in the mid end of the 40s, which was the Chrono Dato Lux, the addition of Lux, meaning it had a moon phase and the first big date in into a wristwatch, more or less, at least on the chronograph, that for sure, maybe not on the three hand. And it had that very wonderful little big date going up to 39, because we didn't invent the sync, which allowed the sync to switch from 31 to 1. So it had to go to 39. But I was totally in love with that thing. And internet was not what it was. It was a nightmare to find. It took me 10 years. Well, now I owned a couple of them because I, even today, if I see one, I need to buy it. It's compulsive. But the good thing is you don't find that many. But I still managed to have a few now. And it's very interesting about the Chrono Dato Lux. So it's a marvel in the sense of it had a digital date. Just remember, it mid of the 40s, and to wait to see a digital date again. I mean, I'm not talking prototyping here. It's a Lontron 189 at the Carrera Dato, like almost 25 years later. So it was a big date. I mean, it's like a little datograph. So this was a wonder. It was an absolute catastrophe from the sales perspective because it was small. It came at a time where the Swiss industry was struggling selling chronographs because people were more into waterproof automatics. And as you know, the Swiss industry didn't produce any automatic chronograph up to 69. We can discuss who were the first. It's a topic for its own. But yes, Androlux is a pure wonder. You also have simple calendar watches. You have traveling clocks. And you know something at Hodinkee about traveling clocks. Just a little joke, but I love traveling clocks. They had an immensely rare watch, which is called the Tinkler, which was the first waterproof automatic repeater. They did it in the 50s. So let's say roughly 40 years before Patek even had the idea of doing such a thing. It's, again, a project done by the Stolz brother, which almost killed the brand. So the brand was always on the edge of killing itself, but also bringing up stuff which was crazy amazing. So yeah, I am still in love with the brand. At some point, I got an interesting phone call. I still remember because it was a wedding of one of my best friends. And I got calls from time to time. You probably know that as well. People offering you stuff. And they say, yeah, I heard you're into Angelus. I say, yes, I am. They too quick. I'm on a wedding. He said, yeah, actually. I say, what are you selling? He said, what model? He said, actually, it's a brand. So to make a long story short, we bought the brand within 7 days. So the original brand. So we have the registration in the US from the origin. So it was the brand was still alive all these years. So they did just what it needed to not lose the registration. And then, yeah, we built it up from then. I think I disappointed almost every Angelus collector on earth and was hated by all my colleagues, fellows collectors, because we did the U10, which was this crazy square tourbillon with a crazy piece of kind of modern watchmaking, which was supposed to be a bit a nod of the period they disappeared and having a lot of little elements of traveling clocks, of mimicking a digital technology which killed Angelus at the time by having a dead beat, which you have to put back at the time. We were very few companies doing dead beats. And it was full of little hints, and it had to be fun. I think it was not really particularly well understood. And it was very funny, actually, to be attacked on all channels by people actually I knew as being as well Angelus collectors and say, who is the idiot who takes such a wonderful vintage brand and does stuff nobody understands? Why does he need? And for me, the idea was pretty simple, actually. Well, it was to say, it has always been very modern, very upfront, very doing crazy stuff. So I didn't see myself taking such a brand and doing and repeating the past when this brand never did it. So maybe with U10, we went a bit too far. Then we did obviously rounds, skeleton tourbillons, split chronographs and everything. Of course, we had a vintage line on, which more or less, I think it's done nowadays by the new team. But yeah, that's how Angelus ended up in my hands. Not sure I did the best job ever, but I had fun. And especially the U10. When I did that, I said, no, I can retire.
This was when you were at LJP and you'd been there for a few years and then had the opportunity to relaunch Angelus.
Absolutely. Yeah. But of course, we had also plans to do a wonderful traditional column wheel, super complex. But again, if you did the Chrono Dato Lux in the 40s, you cannot show up with just a simple column wheel big date 180 years later. It's ridiculous. You need to bring it a huge step further technologically. You need to bring something to the table. And otherwise, to be very honest, why don't you buy an original vintage Chrono Dato if you do something which just mimics badly what has been done in the past? That's that's a problem of these brands, actually. Do you have such a heritage? If you don't have like tens of millions to develop and having time to build it, it's not that easy to make something where you deserve to use a name. So yeah, but I'm still very proud of what we did with Angelus, and I'm happy that it still exists today. But it's interesting being on both sides of the table, being both a collector who is disappointed by not seeing a reedition somehow, which I was not because I could have done it, but and then being confronted to people you know as being collectors as you, finding that, you do things wrong. So it's pretty interesting, you know, because some, I think people in the industry are not collectors. So when they get criticized by people they don't know, talking about product they never heard of. So having like 25 Chronodatos and 6 or 7 Chronodato Lux, I actually know the product of the history pretty well and still decided to not re-edit these watches.
Can you talk a little bit more about this idea? Because it's something we see a lot in the industry, these heritage brands doing some form of reissue. Sometimes it's hated, sometimes it's loved, sometimes it's lambasted for being too on the nose. And then, but on the other side, if you try to push things forward too much, as you did with Angelus, as you've just been talking about, you get the same kind of pushback. So can you talk about just more broadly in the industry, how you think brands should think about this balance?
Yeah, that's a very difficult one, I would say, probably. Well, there are different problems, I would say. And one thing is not understanding your heritage, meaning you have the text, but you don't understand the grammar. So basically, you cannot extract elements. I could write you a thesis about the U10, which is Angelus about it. Obviously, if you need to explain it, it's that your product already failed. But I could explain why Dieter Rams had something to do in that, why, okay? Obviously, but if you are in a state where you have to explain what you did, you probably already failed. But I think the industry, especially when it does re-edition, and also the idea where I did Albison actually, is first of all, they probably don't understand perfectly what they did at the time. So they copy without understanding, which me like copying a text in a foreign language and I just copy it, but I make mistakes because I just don't understand what I'm writing. And then the other aspect is when you try to make what they call neo-vintage is to adapt it to what you think is the taste of the time. And then you decide to add another layer of making it resistant like a Russian tank. Well, we might discuss if these are the most resistant ones, but at least you try to make it rock solid. And then you end up with bulky watches for water resistance, for shock resistance. So actually you lose the what made the thing attractive in the first place, was the elegance. I mean, we could talk, I think, hours for the elegance of ancient Patek Philippe chronographs and what, in my eyes, they lack today. It's a complex topic. So I think you should distinguish maybe watches which have always existed. Like I'm a big, big fan of reversals. I was one of my very big, because I was both very attracted to chronographs and to the brand Jaeger LeCoultre, which is how I started, actually. I was very, very, very attracted in the 90s by the brand and obviously the reversal. So this one, you might just say it's not really a re-edition in the sense it's a stop production. As you know, the Italian came and all the story, which are told every day. But it's a classic or some other watches. But when you go into really doing re-edition of stuff from the 40s, 50s, which has really not been produced for so many years, yeah, it's not the watches I'm attracted to, but I can understand that most people are. And also probably talking about Albison, also understand that probably a lot of people think that it's just not unnecessary in the sense of just give me a good re-edition and I'm happy, right? But as a collector, my dream was always to produce stuff which never existed. I'm not saying that it's always successful, but also with Angelus, I could not imagine putting the name Chronodato on something which would not be tremendously deserving the name.
This is something we do on the Hodiki podcast most weeks, kind of either a wrist check or look at something cool on your desk. And I asked you, for those not watching on YouTube, you're at your office in Salida, it looks like. And I asked you if you had something cool on your desk and you had kind of a funny story to tell about why you don't.
Yeah,
so maybe you could start there.
Yeah, I can start. It was both funny, frightening, and somehow sad for the company as a whole. So as some people knew, we had a terrible storm last year. When I say terrible, it really destroyed the company in a way unseen in Switzerland. We are not used to that kind of elements. So we have just finished more or less reconstruction now 1 year later. So we had for roughly 30 millions of damages. So my office, which is quite in the middle of the building, was still fully devastated. So obviously, being a watch lover, you always accumulate in your desk stuff you want to see, to relax, to enjoy, to study, or to So I had a few, quite a lot of watches actually in my drawers. And I got the news when I was on holidays in Greece. I saw the pictures of the destroyed company and I couldn't fly back immediately. So I flew back as quick as I could. But there was very uncertainty of what happened to my watches because we had no roof anymore. It was flooded with water. So nothing happened to them. Obviously, first, nobody died at the company because we were closed. One guy was quite heavily injured, but is doing great now. So obviously, this was our first concern. But then obviously, I was concerned about my... So yeah, to make a long story short, my watches survived, but I thought I should not have that thing in my drawers, and it killed actually my decoration on my desk, and I had a wonderful little 8 days clock, which was blown away, but I kept it because it's in 1,000 pieces. But I have it as a memento mori, some kind of. I will see what if I put it into some kind of plexiglass. But I kept the thing. I even picked all parts because it was shattered with glass and pieces of the walls on the piece of my desk, which was smashed. And I even collected as many parts of glass and even found the blue hands after an hour of search. I have the hands. I don't know why I did it. I searched for that thing and I have all pieces and it reminds me a lot of things. So yeah, I don't have anything. You didn't ask me. I would have talked, but no, it's my desk is clean as would be a clinic doctor's desk. But yeah, I'm wearing obviously my first prototype. So some people always complain that they saw it on Instagram and it hasn't been delivered. It's mine, you see, guys. I couldn't deliver any yet. So you don't, it's not that you have not been the first to be delivered. It's on my wrist. So yeah, so I'm wearing it, I'm enjoying it. Obviously, I keep on testing it, even though I've tested it long, but know that I finished the first batch. I'm enjoying wearing it.
So maybe we can just start here and you can explain to the people, there might be some misconceptions still, but talk about what is Salida and what is its role in the Swiss watch industry, largely speaking.
Yeah, so Salida is actually a very ancient player, even if people never really realize that. So Salida was founded in 1950 by Mr. Grandjean. And it had been from day one a major player in assembly. But what people have to understand that the industry was always sharing in the sense of having specialized company doing special tasks. So an ébauche, as the name says in French, doesn't sell movement, it sells kits. So ETA has always been, for many years, an ébauche company. It means it never sold finished movement to its clients. It sold raw parts, which were put together by assembler, and they had to buy, on the one hand, the barrels, the jewels, and the escapement. And even the escapement, they could split between the hairspring and their other parts. So Salida was one of these companies buying, let's say, 70% of the kit from ETA, buying the stones, buying the hairsprings, and buying the escapement from Nivarox, which is also like the fusion and combination of different companies. And that it was doing on very large scales from 1950 to the decision of the Swatch Group to say you will die tomorrow because you will not get the parts, you will still assemble. So first of all, people have to understand that this is not, it is a job which was, it was a job way of organizing the industry, which has always existed long before the creation of Salida, and which at some point, some people decided to change the game, the rules of the game. So for Salida, it was obviously the end of its activity because when you are someone who puts things together and you don't get the things you're supposed to put together, basically you just close down. So Miguel, which was the second owner at the time, roughly became the owner at that time, actually, said, okay, we have two options. Or we dare doing it ourselves, or we close or sell it to the people who have the parts. And obviously, you probably don't know Miguel, but he's not the guy who would say, I would let it go. So he said, let's do the components we don't have. So from a pure assembly company, we became a fully fledged producer, which is not an easy thing to do, and took us also some time to be on the extremely high quality level we have now. We had a learning curve of 20 years. And what's very interesting to understand as well is when people say, yeah, but why you started by just copying something existing? But people have to understand there are two main reasons. The first is our clients were still delivered partially by the Swatch Group, so they wanted to have exact equivalent, that you could have a certain watch equipped with an ETA on Salida movement, but they had to be, like to say, 100% similar. That's the first thing. So the industry was calling for perfect copies because they were having two sources for the same thing. The second thing is all our tooling, all our industry was built around assembling that kind of movements, meaning you cannot on an assembly line for Chevrolet then assemble some kind of Ferrari. It's not the way it goes. So it took us a long time first to get to master these products, because I also learned over the years that copying is often much more complicated than creating, because when you create, you make mistakes, but you understand what you did. To be very honest with you, nowadays there are still a few things ETA did or does, I don't know if they still do, we don't understand why.
How big is Salida now, and over your time there, how much has it grown?
Roughly, we and it's not thanks to me, and just to be clear, but yeah, we not doubled, but not far of doubling the number of employees. We have massively verticalized, so we are roughly in the group 1,000 people. So we are at the main quarter, in the headquarters, the one which were destroyed by the storm. We have three huge buildings with roughly 600 people. Then we bought during COVID a turning company, one of the biggest but failing company in Switzerland, which we reconstructed. And since we even put a new 10,000 square foot building, so we built fully new facility. It's a very ancient company from 1884, something like that. Then we have our own decoration ateliers, which are also not in the headquarters. We have our galvanic treatment company, which is the same actually. It's combined with the decoration. And we do have main plates and bridge own company in Germany in near Glashütte, where the know-how lies. So very close to Nürnberg and Langenzöner, where we have roughly 120 people. And we just finished to also add, 250 or 300 square meters just recently, or even a bit more. We are quite verticalized. No, basically, we are verticalized.
What are some, you kind of mentioned some of it here in the evolution of Salida and what it does in the past two decades, basically. But what do you see now as open spaces for potential innovation in the markets or the clients that Salida serves or supplies?
They're different things. I mean, first of all, you asked about what is the place of Salida. Salida is a key player because it's privately owned and it does no politics, in a sense of whoever comes can buy a movement. You can buy a single piece. Obviously, it's not the same price as if you pay a buyer, but you can. Any watchmaker can register and buy parts to serve as a movement. As you know, it has been a big struggle with the Swatch Group over the years and probably other companies as well. It's to get access to the parts. So basically, we support independent watchmakers and repair workshops by providing all technical documents, providing all components, also to service watches done by others, which are on the same, they can use our components wherever they want to. So I think this is a big difference because we have no policy in the sense of forbidding to sell online or having requisite. If you come to us, you want to create your brand, you have an idea, who are we to decide if you have the right to be a watchmaker or not? It's not our job. So this is something very interesting as well as for me, because I meet a lot of young brands, dynamic people doing crazy stuff. So I think it's very important. So we belong to no group. We have no watch brands, so we are not competing with our clients. So this makes, I think, the something a very unique position. And we serve over 300 clients. So it makes, I would say a lot of brands you have seen recently in the Swiss made, and I'm meaning the real Swiss made, like really movements made in Switzerland are not supposed to be, it never existed without us, because we give access to all these people to have these movements. What changed massively, I would say, since I started, not that it directly connected, but we went from a non-existing catalog, in a sense we had no catalog because it was not a standard in the Swiss industry, to a real catalog of 135 pages of complications. And nowadays you can buy a regulator, you can buy all kind of moon phases of chronographs in all kind of variation ways without GMT, with whatever you want. We have a huge diversity. So I think for our brands, it gets really interesting because they can create something of their own. You have a lot of brands using it very intelligently and making quite interesting product, I would say, using the diversity we offer. Then what changed also over time, we created a second company called Manufacture AMT, which is our technological branch. If I can compare it, it's like you had Lemania at the time at other groups, or you had Frédéric Piguet. So clearly we aim another level and another kind of product. But yeah, so Salida has that. And now with a new trend in the industry where brands want something specific, are willing to pay more for the movements, quite massively more. We created EMT, which is an umbrella. Well, it's a company I have, but it's also an umbrella of products. So most of the products are reserved for one client. And so we call that manufacturer, you can call it proprietary. At least the client knows when he buy a certain brand, he will not find that movement or not something close to it. It's not just a question of bridge shape, in another one. So we do quite technical movement with much longer power reserve, 90 hours, multiple ball bearing within one movement, a lot of rubies, undestructible over 10 years. But again, it's not the entry price point anymore. And it's as these brands have a very high standing and have also very good engineers, that we are very interconnected with them. We develop it together. And these movements are made and developed by IMT, but you will just find them under a single brand. And next to it, we have a catalog which is open to most, in the sense of there's a certain volume to buy, but open to any client. As I said, we do no politics, where we do something in between of a very highly evolved Sellita movement. For instance, there's a flyback chronograph, column wheel, which actually at the end you have maybe 20% of original parts in it. So it has a double side winding, it has a column wheel, it has more power reserve, it is flyback. It has a patented friction system for the chronograph, that it has no, the hand moves quite smoothly. So, well, if you put everything together, there is nothing really left from the original product. But obviously, it is an evolution of an SV500. And that one is not claimed to be fully new, but it's 80% new.
Got it. So maybe we can take that as an example, actually, the 5100. Yeah. I've started to see it in at least a few different watches. Maybe some bigger brands, smaller brands that I can think of off the top of my head, an Oak and Oscar and a Ferland Mari we've covered. But you're saying it, while it's a movement that various clients have used, they customize it in terms of bridge shape, in terms of finish, whatever yes. else that make it different. And then that's proprietary to them.
Exactly. But that movement is still the base you will find in others. Some go very far. I cannot mention here if they don't do it. But some invest heavily in having all bridges and all stuff done to their requirement. Some do just one bridge. Some use it as a manual wind. Some use it as... But just to give you an example, you can choose from 5 different colors for the column wheel. From fully blue, fully black, big bicolor, gray. So the people... And then, yeah, and the new tendency is at least you started by doing own roto shapes, something you saw in the 90s. You know, you did your logos of the Chrono Swiss stuff of our friend who passed away, Gert-Rüdiger Lang. And nowadays it goes further that you do bridges, yeah, like full bridges. And then, of course, it has a cost.
Something else we've mentioned before on this podcast, or just mentioned as one of the major problems facing the industry over the next generation, is the potential shortage or the difficulty of finding watchmakers. And you just mentioned how much Sellita has grown over the past handful of years. Can you discuss... Yeah. What that issue looks like, or how much even is an issue from your perspective?
Yeah,
and from
Sellita's
perspective?
It has been a huge issue, but not only on watchmakers in general of qualified people in the industry. It has really been an issue. Also, engineer for developing movements or technical. When you look at the engineering at Sellita, for instance, we have more engineers specialized in developing machines than actually doing movements, because we do all our movement, all our machines inside for assembly. Because you can imagine in Switzerland, we have Rolex, Swatch Group, and us doing really big volumes. So you can imagine these machines you need are not freely available. So at some point, Miguel, the owner, he said, look, I don't develop machines that I see them somewhere else. So we had a full Sellita engineering, which are like just engineers who developed assembly lines and all the techniques, laser welding and all that stuff in-house. So also finding these people is very tricky. Finding good movement designer is extremely tricky because everybody wants them, and obviously skilled and trained watchmakers. Well, we have a quite easy, we try to work as much as we can with schools, because the funny thing is everybody wants qualified people, but nobody wants to qualify them. So we are very popular because we have such a deep know-how in the house. So we are probably one of the best school after the school, because you can learn everything because we do all in-house. So you can go through, you understand, you have a deep understanding. Also, I would call the black box, or the very complex escapement question, which you usually don't address at watchmakers because they buy the things. And then we try to train them. Obviously, after a few years, you always have the risk to losing them to others, but we train. We also have an internal school where we train people which are not necessarily watchmakers to start with. Also coming a lot from south of Europe, because, as you know, it had been quite difficult economic years. So we have an internal school where we train these people to become qualified watchmaker and to be able to evolve within the company. And it's something we're very proud of. And it's even our technical director who teaches personally to these people, which is, shows also probably the importance it has to us. So all these little elements, help you to find people. And but it stays a struggle. I think that the crisis now will probably ease that a bit. Because as you know, in the last 3 or 4 years, we had 7,000 in the industry, more people working in the industry. So everybody was trying to find talents. And as the volume seems to be reducing now, probably you will have less pressure. But on the long run, I think qualified people will always be the most precious asset of any company.
You kind of mentioned it there, but it's something that's starting to be covered in the broader mainstream press and watch press, the amount to which the Swiss watch industry is slowing down, production is slowing down. Bloomberg has reported, for example, some manufacturers, suppliers, even sort of seeking state aid to slow down their production lines for a little bit. Can you just talk about how that's affecting where you are in Switzerland at all?
Well, we have the chance of having such a broad audience of clients on some doing still pretty well. There are a few launches, which you have also seen on online brands, like very, very, very beautiful watches who still sell crazily well. Underdog and these people who do very, very great jobs, you see they manage to sell. And high quality product, even if they get criticized for the price, if the people would have a closer look, they would say that it's an amazing offering. But it's not to me to say that. But we have a chance to be working both for very small, very successful brands and very large, still very successful brands. But yeah, we see the slowdown now. We feel it. We hadn't. We are not on the list of companies right now asking for shortage in work or having any kind of support, state support. We are in this lucky position that we don't need to have it now. But a lot of factors are coming together. I mean, as a collector, I think yourself, we have seen crazy years, which are obviously not close to normality. I mean, you cannot be on waiting list of brands which has just been created. Come on. At some point you need to relax a bit. I mean, we're not selling a cure against diseases. We're selling watches people actually basically don't need. So I think we are going back to normality. It's good. We have seen hypes in vintage. We had the chronograph hype, which faded away, I would say, 2 years ago, where people were paying crazy money for Valjoux 22. I love these, actually. I have a lot. I should have sold them, but I'm a collector. So I keep the stuff. But my point is, we have seen also crazy years where I would say the expectation were not realistic. That being said, I mean, that goes back to normal. I think it's healthy. It's because two watches should not be primarily an investment vehicle, because they are not. And it's a lie saying something else. They should be wear and enjoyed. The problem I see is a bit deeper, is the relevance for the Swiss industry over the last 15 years. We lost almost 15 million. So we halved the volume. We just keep on increasing the price. And my personal view on that, I'm not talking on behalf of Celida, is the Swiss made, I think even Nicolas Hayek said it, needs to be a pyramid. He said to have Breguet, I need Swatch. And I think the industry obviously needs the Swatch Group as a base and needs also to appeal to a broader audience and to sell watches to many people. And it's essential that you can buy, I think, a Swiss made watch, might it be a Tissot or Longines whatsoever, for 2,000 francs. And still have an access. And I think for the industry, we struggle probably in the entry price level to stay relevant somehow over the last years and to stay attractive. And I think the big question we should ask is not the economic downturn we are facing now, is on a more structural level, what could we do that watches get sexy again somehow? And as small brands show it, how to do it. I mean, you have a lot of offering I find exciting. But it's more an independent, smaller brands, very flexible. And this industry should really ask itself, how can we be fun? I mean, the Moons watch has been an amazing success, which proves if with a good idea, you can do crazy stuff. So my point is, I think we should remember in Switzerland that we have nothing else than our creativity. I mean, we have no resources. We have no commodities, nothing. So, and to be relevant against something highly technological, which is not a watch, but it's much more than that, is a tool for the health question and everything, which is an Apple or any digital watch. It's very difficult. I always thought that you could die technologically only once, you know, since the quartz killed us. I said nothing else could kill us again, because once you have been overtaken technologically, everything which comes afterwards, well, you're already late, you know. So we had a different status. We had a status of being a jewelry for men, of something you could repair forever. So we have a lot of things which are, I think, in our favor. But I am very afraid of this loss of volumes because people have to remember, as an industry in Switzerland, we have the same supplier. The ones we go at Supercellita buying billions of components are the same, doing pinions, wheels, or whatsoever for the very big ones. And you would not see a luxury industry in Switzerland if we don't have the base to keep all these machines running. And I think the industry as a whole and some groups which are more active in it in particular will probably have to find ways to do more attractive watches or to talk to a new, a younger audience and to be relevant, stay relevant.
I'm glad you made this point because it's one I've made on the pages of Hodinkee before. People at a high level will tend to track just the top level, you know, export number, how the total value of watches that are being exported from Switzerland a year, which totally can obfuscate what you're saying about the number or the volume that has completely been decimated over the past decade.
Yeah.
That said, there are some bright spots. You mentioned the Moonswatch. I think the PRX has been a broad success.
Yeah, wonderful success. Yeah.
Surely there are others like the Hamilton khaki field.
Yeah, and also the last carbon one is also, I think, it will be a great hit. I hope for them.
The new Tissot PRX. Yeah, it's super cool.
Yeah, right? It's great. Yeah.
I'm wondering if you have any other things that you would like to see at that, call it entry-level space, under $1,000, under $500, that would help the industry besides the massive success of the Moonswatch. Anything else you think the Swiss watch industry could do better at that level?
Yeah, it's not a single thing. I think it's a lot of things that you said, the PRX. I think it's really an amazing watch if people look at it closely. What you get for the price. Of course, if you say you want an Apple because you want Apple Watch because you want to track your basic data, which I can understand, you will never compete, no matter the material you use or no matter how much you skeletonize the thing. But yeah, trying maybe to better explain to people that the thing can be fixed forever, that it is something different, that it... Look, I still wear my first... I spent all the money when I was starting with working at the university. I spent it on the reverse, so like 30 years ago. Man, the thing is still relevant. It's I would have bought anything else at the time, a laptop or even a mountain bike, which I really liked at the time a lot. I mean, yeah, it would be in the museum of technology. I mean, my reverse could as well, but my goodness, it's still the classic. My point is really focusing on that. And again, look, we talk in such small numbers. You know what I mean? I mean, come on, we're talking selling 15 million. What is it when you look at the population we have? You know what I mean? I mean, if I would be at Apple and talking about having 15 million more sales of an item, they would probably smile at me and say, yeah, it's great, but we are one company. It's one of our products. I mean, these people, I don't even show that we deserve to be called an industry. Are we an industry yet? No, we are come some kind of little ateliers, you know. Come on, in an industry, when you say to people, as an industry, we lost 15 billion, it's a catastrophe. They said, yeah, is it a daily production, a monthly production? They said, no, it's for the entire industry for a year. Say, oh, guys, my goodness, what are you selling exactly? Hand-painted something? No, I mean, we are ridiculously small. I mean, and that's a problem. If you get too small, you get irrelevant in the sense of also the Swiss made. For me, it needs to be a brand which is somehow obtainable. You know what I mean? If you can just start to be Swiss made by having a Richard Mille, an Audemars Piguet, Royal Oak, or some kind of Patek, I mean, let's start with Rolex. But come on, that cannot be the Swiss made. It's not a Swiss made. It used to be. It's not a Swiss made. It should be. You should be relevant. But yeah, to come back to your question, if I would know that, probably I would be rich and not sitting here. But what is exactly the product we need? Probably a lot and a lot of different initiatives. But I think it's both the product. It's the communication and the sexiness of how you sell it to new generation, which I'm not a part of, and also probably how you fully embrace new channels of distribution, which also allow you to have direct access. I mean, we had this discussion on and about is a Moonswatch no sold online or not, which model is, what the thing is. But again, I'm not a marketing specialist by any means, but yeah, the industry has a lot of things to face. And I think the volume are much more important figures than the value.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up the last point there, because I asked you about the product and things we can do better on the things the Swiss watch industry, or we could do better on the product side. But of course, that's only one piece of it. One of the other things is the business model itself of how we sell watches and looking at how to do that online better, how to do that better direct to consumers, because really what you have to do is change the entire business model, especially at this low $500,000 price point. Because if you're selling those through retail, there has to be margin for the brand, for the retailer, for the distributor, all of this type of stuff. And it's something that these small brands have figured out how to cut out all of those people and just make a good product. And what you see is what you get. And there's not the markup of all those intermediate steps. And the Swiss watch industry, it sounds like we'll probably have to start figuring out how to do that a little bit better, especially at this lower price point, because otherwise people are just going to buy an Apple Watch or whatever else, as you kind of mentioned there.
Yeah, and you can have a few showrooms and everything. I mean, I strongly believe in the multi-channel if you're big enough to do that, because there's still brick and mortar, which is attractive to some. But again, you need to adapt. And as you said, I think obviously if you do the brick and mortar, you have to have multiples, which obviously makes your price quite expensive. And again, yeah. So I think we have to. There's a lot of work to do in the industry.
Well, this kind of gets us to what you've decided to do on the brand side of things, which is Albashorn. So maybe you could start just by, well, I'll let you talk about it because it's obviously at a much smaller scale than any of this, but maybe if you could start by talking about the concept of the brand and how you're going about introducing the product.
I think the most important thing to know about that, I did the watch I wanted to do without any consideration of how would I sell it? It's not that I figure out something. I said it has to be massively done different, and I will prove the world that I have something. I just wanted to make a watch and a different watch because I have a few models coming, and I just did that. To be very honest, it was a quite selfish thing. Of my concept was pretty simple. It was for me to say, okay, I want to do something vintage because it was a given. I will present some next year probably something very contemporary, but not under that brand. Something I did for 8 years, a very complex movement, just for the fun of making it. So that's nothing to, but Albison was really set to be the watches which could have been and they forgot or didn't do. And the watches I would want to wear and want to own. So obviously it had to be chronographs. 99% will be hand-worn. So nothing of that will make it a success in a sense of broad audience. But my concept was pretty simple, was to say, okay, I'm a nerd. I should be able for every single watch over a certain period of time to find other people who want to join me on that dream. And it's why it's also not, it's no compromise in a sense. I didn't add, and it's not a product date by the committee. It's something I wanted to do. I fully understand that people will tell me I'm not into regatta. I'm not into that. I wear YAs, no date. Yeah, you will not, it's not supposed to please. I mean, I hope it please at least 100 people. But my concept is if I found 100 people have the same pleasure as me and having it and seeing that it's original, even if it's fully connected with history, and I'm not hiding that I have links to some Longines design I love, to some Mido designs, multi-center chrono. But again, when you look at the thing, you say, damn, that thing never existed before, even if it could have, and it might remind you, but you say, it's just not a ripoff. It's clearly inscribed into an history. It respects all the codes. And so it started actually more, yeah, during, I was working on a very high-end, very complex movement with a new escapement for like 8 years. And I'm pretty close to fruition, but I was a bit frustrated. It was COVID, and I had this discussion with a friend. There was a new re-edition. I say, my goodness, they have to extend the museum. They did all re-edition of everything. I don't know. They have to go back to ancient Egypt to find new models, you know? And I say, they cannot continue forever. At some point, they have to write a new song, all right? And they say, yeah, is it that easy? I say, look, if you have loved watches that much and you have written about it, studied, yeah, at some point, yeah, you could add lined up to existing watches. And I started to sketch some few ideas. And because I said, yeah, it cannot be a one trick pony. So I ended up having 25 things pretty quickly of watches I would have loved to be made, which were not. Some are technically more ambitious than others. And yeah, and I know William for many years. He's a collector, everything. I showed him a few drawings, and he was attracted to the first drawings of the Maxigraph. The name actually comes from him. The watches exist without the name, and then we refined it, we discussed it, but we agreed pretty quickly on how it should look like. And yeah, you would say starting a brand with an imaginary regatta from 39 of a race of a Lake Geneva nobody except the Swiss ever heard of. Well, how can I say it's not what will save the Swiss industry. But it's what I want to do at night, and what makes me smile on the Saturday morning. Because if it doesn't make me smile on the Saturday morning, I can do something else. So yeah, and for me it was an exercise of doing still something mechanical, interesting, to an affordable price point. When you think of the volume I produce, because I have done like very complex stuff at Arnold. I developed a constant force. I developed multiple tourbillons, complex stuff also based on patents of mine, like things for $200, $250. So these are not the watches your friends usually where. And I found it fun for me as well to learn how to do and respecting all the things I love of quality, of finishing, of case, of movement, everything, something sub 5,000. Well, and it's how Alpison was created. But again, I saw none of the issues of volumes and vision. And I said before, it's really more of something I also strongly believe that over the next years, we will see more and more niche offerings for a very, very targeted audience. That I strongly believe it will not save the volume issue, but it will serve the creativity, diversity, which probably as a whole thing will make watches more interesting for people.
I completely agree with that. Can you talk a little bit more about just the model in which you're launching these? So I think you're doing small batch production of this watch, and then you've got some more in the pipeline.
Yeah. So I try to keep it because I love the job and the opportunities Sellita offers also in creating stuff which are relevant for an industry and not just relevant for me, for myself. And I want to keep it very professional, obviously. I don't want to do a reliable and very thoughtful product. So I took my time. I took 4 years to present the first watch. So I really engineered a lot around it. Yeah, I started with this one, which is a bit of a crazy, crazy thing of having a Regatta Woody clutch is a little patent, and which is very, very niche into a niche, making a Regatta imaginary vintage Regatta. I have to laugh about myself when I say that. So yeah, I have a lot of things to come with little technical. The other thing in my book about chronograph, I wrote a lot about the Type 20 and all the execution and all the makers. And it's something I really love. And it has no ancestor. Well, the ancestor is the German chronograph from the Second World War, but it has no direct ancestor. So the next thing I will launch is a very pretty, very funny little ancestor to the Type 10, Type 20 called the Type 10. So it gives me 10 numbers to add. I can do the Type 11, the Type 12. So the Type 10, the Type 11 and 12 exist as dashboards actually in the French army. But yeah, I will launch end of October the Type little batch of 20, 25 pieces of an imaginary ancestor of the Type 20 called the Type 10, which I'm pretty proud of because it has a different dial layout than obviously the Maxigraph. So I have some original dashboard design to it, a little indicator, a little complication, which I patented, which existed on clocks in airplanes, but I find a new way of making it. It's why I could patent it. And yeah, I think it will be a funny little thing. I'm proud of making thin watches. So it's 12 millimeters on top of the crystal because all these people trying to measure without crystal always drives me crazy. So I'm really on top of it.
Amen.
I'm 12.
Yes.
Yeah, that's my goodness. I mean, it's you buy the entire thing, you know. It's not that you buy the crystal separately and you put it on your watch. So I'm 12 millimeter, which actually puts me below the original, I have to say. I'm proud of that. I'm 39 on the case, 41 something on the bezel, so it wears a bit larger because I have a very small wrist, but I try to have a 39 like they had. But the bezel, I have my signature concave bezel, which is a bit,
it's cool. It reminds me of old like Breitling Super Oceans or something.
Yeah. But I'm a big fan of the 202. You will see something of the 2005. So I try not to copy anything. But yeah, I'm crazy in love with that thing. And all these Breitlings are crazy. Yeah, the very first Super Ocean chronographs. And yeah, so I have a few of signature of having, you know, my some operated chronograph and so yeah. So the next thing is that, and then will come the imaginary watch of the. For the Himalaya, for the Swiss expedition of 52, as you know, we have a huge fight for the final climb of the English, if it was, Rolex or not, or well, we know it's not. But I will not enter into that. But as you might know, Swiss, we always like to be the lucky losers. We like to be second. We don't like to be in the spotlight. So we had an expedition on 52. We failed 200 meters from the summit. And there is no watch known to that. So I think Alpison should have provided something specially made for that. So this will be as a Sundergraph launched somewhere next year and so on and so forth. I also have a chronograph made for the moon called the Spaciograph, but actually was lost by the post. It never ended up at the NASA. So it's my vision of, no, but kidding apart, you know, there's an interesting thing about that. When Kennedy said in 61, we will go to the moon and come bring a band and bring him back, it's very interesting to see that almost everything was designed from scratch to achieve that, but they actually used a stopwatch, which is crazy good for the Speedmaster, which shows how much an amazing watch it is and still today. But it's interesting that none really, I think Bulova tried something, but that nobody really designed something specifically for the moon. And I think it's time that it's, so I will try to do something for the moon like it should have been done in 65.
A lot of fun to be had. I like the general philosophy of sort of imaginary vintage watches, as you call them. It's slightly cheeky, but like respectful of the history of the Swiss watch industry at the same time, which I really enjoy.
Yeah, I try to be just a bit cheeky because still these watches are not $500. So at some point, there are also people, and I really try, but I hope that they will still be good looking in 10 years. And as they have something of their own, or I think they can age gracefully because they are not the ripoff of something which is, because you know how it is, you can buy a watch which is reminiscent of something you like, you will always want to have the real thing. And I really hope that mine is original enough that they can stand by themselves. And I probably the reason they can age gracefully is because they have something of their own.
Yeah, completely. Well, thank you so much for giving us a little bit of background on Albashorn, everything you've got in the store as well. And more broadly than that, talking about your time at Salida, its importance in the Swiss watch industry, and more broadly about your career. So thank you so much for your time, Sebastian.
Thanks
more to come
again
on Albashorn on the
me.
Website soon.
Yes.
Yeah, of course. And thank you all for listening to Hodinkee Radio. Thanks to Vic Ottomanelli for editing. And we'll see you all again next week for another episode of Hodinkee Radio.